In our first story, Behind Mansion Walls, the male heir to a billion-dollar fortune,
one of the wealthiest real estate families in New York,
turns cross-dressing fugitive with blood on his hands.
He dresses as a woman who's apparently experienced at dismembering bodies.
And later, his vast wealth funds the local church by day.
He was a pillar of the community.
And bankrolls the underworld by night.
6 days of the week, he's pursuing cocaine, prostitutes. The seventh day was church, family.
I'm Christopher Mason. Behind mansion walls, wealth will cover a multitude of sins. Until murder draws back the curtain on a world of secret lies.
Get all the crap.
If you control real estate, you control everything. Politics, business, and views of Central Park. Just ask Seymour Durst.
Seymour Durst, to understand who he was, you know, he was considered one of the top five most powerful real estate barons in New York.
The Durst family is New York real estate royalty. Manhattan is their kingdom, with properties worth billions in today's money. In the 1970s, Emperor of the Realm Seymour Durst is grooming his firstborn son, Bobby, for the throne. But he's a reluctant heir.
I want you to redevelop our properties on the west side.
He did try to extricate himself from the Durst family in the 1970s.
If this is too much for you, I can get Douglas to do it.
But he was lured back to New York by his father.
But the corporate world just isn't Bobby's scene. He's more the arty type.
His scene was basically being by himself and smoking pot. He was reserved and basically kept to himself. He was socially awkward.
For those who know about Bobby's past and what he witnessed as a young boy, it's no wonder he has issues. Local newspapers reported the death of Bernice Durst as an accident, but the family would later acknowledge Bobby's mother committed suicide. And seven-year-old Bobby was there when it happened. The experience would stay with him for the rest of his life.
As he got older and as he developed, you know, these issues he had as a child, they kicked in, and they kicked in with a vengeance.
But one day in 1970, a new woman comes into Bobby's life. An innocent young girl named Kathleen McCormick. Unlike Bernice Durst, Kathy isn't from a wealthy Jewish family. She's blue-collar Catholic. But like Bobby's mom, she's beautiful, and Bobby adores her.
He was taken with her. She was taken with him. They were a love story.
Kathy's friend Gilberta Najami recalls the whirlwind courtship that quickly led to marriage.
She would wait at home while Robert was in New York and wait for his phone call, and her face would smile, you know, when he called, and they were obviously in love.
For a while, Bobby and Kathy are happily married.
How are you going to do that?
But it isn't long before cracks begin to show.
The marriage started out well, then after a couple of years, it began to deteriorate. And that's when she started to see a different side to him.
Well, in that case,
the lovebirds' marriage turns sour when Kathy makes a horrifying discovery. Bobby has a violent streak.
They would get into arguments. There would be physical confrontations. There would turn to beatings. Friends see her with bruises on her body.
All the friends knew there was domestic violence going on, that he was beating her and that he was threatening her. Because we were getting woken up by phone calls in the middle of the night.
We should go to the police. There's no point.
Perhaps seeking alternative ways to express his anger, Durst undergoes primal scream therapy. But those who hear the scream of Bobby Durst are disturbed. It sounds more like the howl of a wild animal than a human being.
Beating
going through my things.
Kathy threatens Bobby with divorce and says she wants a settlement. But Bobby tells her she won't get a dime.
She wasn't asking for a lot of money. It's not like she wanted millions of dollars.
Kathy stays in the marriage until January 1982.
Kathy called me and said, Gilberta, I have to get out of here. He is driving me crazy.
Kathy joins her friend for a family meal.
Difficult course.
But the peace is soon shattered.
After she'd been there an hour or two, the phone started ringing, and it was Robert. And he was screaming. Everyone could hear.
Get your cell phone right now.
Screaming.
I'm having dinner with friends.
Everybody in my family knew that, you know, there was going to be a major fight when they got home.
Thank you so much for having me.
And as Kathy prepares to leave, she says something to Gilberta that chills her to the bone.
We stood on my front porch and she said, Gilberta, and she looked me dead in the eye, promise me if something happens to me tonight, you'll check it out. I'm afraid of Bobby.
It's the last time Gilberta will ever see Kathy.
I'm scared.
I still wonder why I let her go. I wonder why I didn't call her to make sure she got home. There's so many questions.
Bobby will later say that he and Kathy had argued, but he then drove his wife to the station where she caught a train back to Manhattan.
It was Bobby who subsequently, 5 days later, reported her missing. So there was a major investigation that was conducted, and it became a front page in the newspapers because of who the Dursts were. The wife of real estate baron is missing. A reward was posted. Bobby had given his story, but then it began little chunks of his story began to basically peel away, and police began to suspect him when they heard about the beatings, when they heard that she wanted to divorce him.
Robert Durst enlists the help of his friend, writer Susan Berman, to talk to the media and police.
Susie Berman was by Robert's side the whole time, and she protected him. The whole time she protected him.
Gilberta Najami wants to get to the bottom of what happened to Kathy. She searches Bobby and Kathy's vacation home.
I was looking in particular for the clothes that Kathy had on when she was at my house the previous Sunday. I did not find those.
Then she makes a shocking discovery.
Her mail was in the garbage. Her clothes were thrown out. Her books were in the garbage.
He was erasing every last sign that she had ever even existed in his life.
Suspicion surrounds Bobby Durst, but no body is found. And without evidence against him, Kathy's disappearance remains just another missing persons case.
It will be 17 years before this cold case is revived by an eager young detective who believes he can prove Kathy's disappearance is really a murder case. The detective wants to interrogate Susan Berman, who may have been involved in a cover-up, but he will never get the chance.
I was telling the police and any authority that would listen to me, they need to go interview Susie Berman. I said it on television. I said it in People magazine. People magazine came out December 4th of 2000. The police were on their way to California to interview her. On December 24th of 2000, Susan was found dead in her apartment in Los Angeles with a single gunshot to the back of the head.
It has all the hallmarks of a professional hit, but something doesn't add up.
You know, she wasn't someone that was trusting, so she wouldn't let anyone into her home. So police know it had to be a friend. It had to be someone that she knew well. And whoever it was, and she was leading to the back of the house. And as she was walking, the person was behind her and simply just pulled his hand up and pulled the trigger, and she was dead.
The timing of the murder also seems suspicious. Berman was due to be interviewed for the reopened investigation into Kathy Durst's disappearance. Kathy's friends and family can't believe it's only a coincidence.
They always believe that Susan Berman knew what happened to Kathy.
Was Susan Berman the woman who knew too much? Durst is now a suspect in his wife's disappearance and the murder of his best friend. He denies any involvement in either case and goes into hiding. But it's only the beginning. The story of Bobby Durst is about to get really strange.
Robert Bobby Durst was the heir apparent to a billion-dollar real estate fortune. Now he's gone into hiding. He's wanted for questioning by New York State authorities in connection with the 1982 disappearance of his wife, Kathleen, and by the LAPD in connection with the murder of his friend, Susan Berman, in December 2000.
After word came out, after the news was published, that he was under investigation again for this 18-year-old disappearance, he fled to Galveston, Texas.
No one has seen much of Durst since the murder of his friend, Susan Berman. And perhaps even if they had crossed his path, they wouldn't have recognized him, because Bobby has given himself quite a makeover.
When you're trying to avoid prying eyes, a good disguise is a must. Some opt for the traditional dark glasses and mustache. Others lay low under the wide brim of a hat. Bobby Durst takes a more dramatic approach. He transforms himself into a deaf, mute woman.
Durst would later admit he wasn't much good at passing as a woman. Once, while sitting in a bar, he accidentally set fire to his wig. Not very ladylike.
Bobby comes to Galveston, Texas in December 2000 to lay low as a woman. But a headless corpse is about to take a starring role in the biggest drama that Galveston has ever seen.
I was at home and I received a call from the Galveston Police Department. It said they found a torso floating in Galveston Bay. I asked them to repeat that because I wasn't sure I heard them right. They repeated it and then I went out to the scene. There was a headless, legless, armless torso floating in the bay. And then there were some bags that were found floating that appeared to have body parts in them.
Investigators on the scene search the garbage bags and find the severed limbs of the corpse. But the human puzzle lacks a vital piece, the head.
We found everything except the head. The first thought was, where is this going to go? Where are we going to get a lead to trace back what happened?
Then, inside one of the bags, the first clue to unlocking one of the strangest stories in American criminal history.
In one of those garbage bags, there was a piece of mail that indicated a residence in Avenue K in Galveston.
The residence is a small boarding house with cheap rooms to rent. Investigators send the hands of the corpse to forensics for fingerprint checks, while an officer is dispatched to Avenue K.
We had a house, but we didn't know which of the four apartments we needed to look into.
Police interview the residents from apartments 3 and 4, but there's no answer from numbers 1 and 2. Apartment 2 is rented by a 71-year-old male, Morris Black. Apartment 1 is occupied by an elderly lady named Dorothy Siner. Then, cops get an ID on the floating man puzzle.
We were able to identify the body, the fingerprints from the arms that were located inside the plastic bags.
The soggy body parts belong to the resident of Apartment 2, Morris Black.
Locals describe Morris Black as a cantankerous loner. He was once arrested for threatening to blow up the offices of a utility company because he thought his electricity bill was too high. But how does a grumpy old man end up butchered and dumped in a watery grave.
We'd already done a search warrant on Morse Black's apartment by this time and found that it was completely cleaned out, not a single fingerprint, which was extremely unusual given the man lived there.
But the hallway is a different story. Who needs prints when you've got blood?
Blood was appeared to be mopped in the common hallway and towards the doorway of apartment number 2.
With no sign of Dorothy Siner, police fear she may also be a victim. So they search her apartment, and the bloody mystery goes deeper.
Inside apartment number 2, we found cuts in the linoleum kitchen floor. We found blood spatter on the wall. Once the linoleum was removed from the floor, there was pooling of blood underneath.
Dorothy's apartment looks like a slaughterhouse. But tests show all the blood belongs to Morris Black. So where is the quiet old lady?
Just receiving the trash.
We discovered a receipt for some eyeglasses from a local optometrist for some glasses for Robert Durst. Well, we wondered, who's Robert Durst?
Durst is due to pick up his glasses within the next few days. So the cops set up a sting and arrest him on suspicion of murder. In Durst's vehicle, police find multiple pieces of evidence linking him to the killing and dismemberment of Morris Black. And they make another discovery. Dorothy Siner is, in fact, Robert Durst.
It wasn't exactly a master of disguise type job. He pretty much threw on a wig.
On October 9th, 2001, Durst is charged with murder and locked up with bail set at
$300,000. $300,000 bail is 99 times out of 100 more than enough to ensure that someone's not going anywhere on a charge that's as serious as murder. But what they had not reckoned on was that this was a guy who could produce $250,000 as easily as I could produce 10 bucks.
Durst makes his one phone call and posts bail the following day. Then he goes on the run.
Bobby Durst is dubbed America's first billion-dollar fugitive. But his wealth is not the only unique thing about him.
While he was on the run, there were all sorts of sightings, all sorts of people coming out saying that they had seen him at a gay bar dressed as a woman or seen him here dressed as a woman.
But the fugitive isn't free and footloose for long.
Thank you, officer. Okay. All right, look, I'm going to need to see some ID.
6 weeks later, he's arrested in Pennsylvania for shoplifting.
Robert steals a Band-Aid, and then on his way out of the store, steals a chicken salad sandwich.
When this freakish-looking thief goes for the glove box, alarm bells go off. And a search of the vehicle makes the officer glad he trusted his instincts.
It's not trouble, but I don't want you to get it anymore.
Police discover 2 loaded handguns. They also find Morris Black's ID, nearly $40,000 in cash, and a bag of marijuana.
What's the big deal, officer?
The billionaire had $40,000 in the car. He had $500 in his pocket, and he steals a Band-Aid and gets caught. And I'm like, what a fitting ending to your run as a fugitive.
Durst is arrested and extradited back to Galveston, Texas. This time, bail is set at $1 billion. Try getting that through Western Union. In September 2003, Durst finally faces trial for the murder of Morris Black. On the prosecution side, it looks like an open and shut case.
I really felt the evidence was overwhelming. I was very confident that he was going to be convicted.
But Bobby Durst won't go down without a fight.
He hires the dream team. He gets the best attorneys, the best criminal attorneys available in Texas.
Durst admits he killed his neighbor, Morris Black, but claims it was self-defense. He says he returned home one day to find Black inside his apartment holding a gun.
Look at my gun. It's your gun. You want me to shoot you with it?
A struggle ensued, and Black was accidentally shot in the face. The defense claims Durst then panicked, and fearing that it would appear he'd intentionally murdered Black, in a state of madness, he dismembered and disposed of his corpse. But citing results from Morris Black's autopsy, the prosecution argues the dismemberment was not the work of someone in a panicked state.
The cuts on the legs and arms and neck were very smooth, very almost professional looking, no hesitation, almost like a surgeon.
He calmly and methodically cut Morris up and packaged him like a side of beef.
The prosecution argues Durst had planned Black's murder because he wanted to steal his identity and go on the run.
He made preparations to leave. He had withdrawn large sums of money to travel with. The bow saw was bought at least 7 days prior to the killing.
After a two-month trial and 5 days of deliberation, the jury returns with a verdict that shocks everyone. Bobby Durst is not guilty.
I remember looking over at Mr. Durst himself when they read the not guilty verdict, and he kind of looked down for a second, and his jaw hung open for a couple of seconds.
But as jury members talk to the media in the aftermath of the trial, the deciding weakness in the prosecution's case emerges. They couldn't prove that the killing wasn't in self-defense. And with the only charge being murder, the jury had no choice but to find Durst not guilty. In the end, Bobby Durst serves a few years in prison for gun charges and skipping bond. For the dismemberment of Morris Black's corpse, he's found guilty of evidence tampering.
Released from jail, Bobby signed up for cooking classes at a culinary school in Houston run by the mother of a friend of mine. The topic of the class? Knife skills. The grim joke at the cooking school was, he already knows how to chop. Now he needs to learn how to fillet.
After completing probation, Durst moves back to New York to resume his life. The disappearance of his ex-wife, Kathy, remains unsolved. Kathy's best friend, Gilberta Najami, will never give up her search for answers.
When Kathy made me promise to check it out, I had no idea what I was committing myself to. I'm doing the best I can to keep my promise.
Still to come, behind mansion walls, sometimes the spotless robes of a saint.
He was a pillar of the community.
Hide the blood-stained sins of the man.
He wanted pleasure. He wanted cocaine. He wanted prostitutes.
Hear the words millionaire businessman, and you think flashy cars, private jets, weekends at the country club. You don't think nursing homes and church. But that's what this man is all about. Helmut Buxbaum is a devout churchgoer and the owner of a $22 million nursing home empire in Ontario, Canada.
He said to one of his family members at one point, I'm not going to be poor, I'm going to have people work for me. He came to Canada in the late 50s with $5, and by the mid-80s, he had an empire worth $22 million. Pretty darn bit of good work there, to be honest.
My father worked very hard. He would work sometimes 16, 18 hours a day.
But as Helmut's third son, Philip, recalls, even as the business expands into an empire, his hardworking dad keeps the silver spoon well out of reach.
I had no idea we had money until I was about 15. I had no clue, because we lived such normal lives.
And elder care isn't exactly a glamorous industry.
It's not sexy running nursing homes. It's not like drilling for oil and the well comes in and you're a wealthy man. It's not like looking for gold like a great uncle of mine did and strike your Eldorado.
And that's probably just as well, because Helmut comes from a strict religious background where sexy is a dirty word. In fact, religion is Helmut's middle name. Literally, it's Troigot, meaning God is faithful.
Helmut Buxbaum was a person who had religious inscriptions on his business card, on the gates to the home. His name was up on a plaque on the church as one of the benefactors of the church.
Each year, Helmut donates between $200,000 and $400,000 to his local church in the village of Komoka, where he lives with his wife Hannah and their six children.
He was a pillar of the community and very loving and dedicated to his family.
Helmut's wife, Hannah Buxbaum, is a paragon of the Christian spirit.
The image of her and her community was she was, I would say, a saint.
They seem to be a model family.
You know, it all just seems a little too perfect, doesn't it? In my experience, the cleaner the closet door, the dirtier the skeletons within. Does Helmut, God is faithful, Buxbaum, have a dark side?
Helmut, are you all right?
Yes, I'm fine.
I think that he felt that if he worked hard and believed in God and did all the right things and was a devoted family man and a pillar in his church, that he could indulge himself from time to time. And ultimately, the from time to time became more and more and more and more.
Some indulge in chocolate. Helmut Buxbaum has a different guilty pleasure.
He couldn't be satisfied with stamp collecting. He liked prostitutes. He liked cocaine.
It all started with pornography. But after his first visit to a brothel, Helmut discovered what real-life women will do for a man with money.
Now, don't you ever have children. It'll ruin your body.
And he liked it. A lot. The hookers and dealers like it, too. Their new clients' cash flow never seems to run dry.
He provided them with money for coke, provided them with money for women. They loved it. They had themselves a multimillionaire in their clutches.
But Helmut doesn't go for the upscale scene. He prefers a back alley strip joint in the seedy underbelly of London, Ontario.
This is a guy who could have rented a private plane, flown down to Las Vegas, taken a suite at the best hotel, snorted cocaine out of Lalique dishes, and had the best prostitutes in the world. And it wouldn't have cost him anything in terms of his vast income. He didn't do that.
Meanwhile, Helmut maintains his holier-than-thou image at his church.
I can't even imagine how he would sit and move from the pew and then go to the bar and carry on a conversation. It's a different world, and he could operate in these two different worlds.
Helmut is living a secret life. But like a good Christian, he confesses his sins to his wife, Hannah. He knows she can find it in her heart to forgive.
He would confess to her that he was seeing prostitutes and he was taking cocaine and he was hanging around a bad crowd, and she would forgive him time after time after time after time.
But what does the man upstairs think of all this? When Helmut suffers a stroke just weeks after his 43rd birthday, Hannah wonders if it's God's retribution. Perhaps now this pillar of the community will start behaving himself. Or will he?
Helmut Buxbaum was a poor religious boy who came to Canada looking for opportunity and found it. He now owns a $22 million nursing home empire and is a pillar of his church in Komoka, Ontario. But his saintly exterior masks inner demons.
He wanted pleasure. He wanted cocaine. He wanted prostitutes.
Now he's had a stroke, and after a long stay in the hospital, he's lucky to be alive. Like a lightning bolt from the heavens, surely this is Helmut's wake-up call, to mend his wicked ways? Or is it a sign to get his kicks while he still can? Helmut prefers the second option.
He started to turn into his alter ego. A wild man, sort of out of control. You know, I'll do whatever I want to do, when I want to do it, how long I want to do it.
Good stuff, huh?
I'm alive!
It was like the governor, the little piece of machinery in a motor that prevents it from overheating or over-revving. It was like that governor that, you know, oh, I really shouldn't do this. But that was gone. And all of a sudden, he became very pleasure-seeking and not even trying to cover it up.
Helmut is spending more on hookers and drugs than ever before. And the shady characters he deals with are only too happy to provide their illicit wares.
Oh, yeah.
For dealer and pimp Squirrel Barrett, Helmut is like the goose that laid the golden egg.
Hey, Squirrel Barrett, the main point guy, was living off Buxbaum. He was ripping him off on every drug deal. He was selling him drugs, keeping a bunch for himself, had a very lucrative business, and he would talk to all his other friends in the seedy underworld and say, this guy's got a lot of money. This guy can do a lot of stuff for us, and we need more drugs for him.
At the same time, Helmut makes sure he donates even more than usual to his church.
Money will buy you friends in low-life circles, and it'll buy you friends in other circles.
With nothing to stop him, Helmut dives deeper and deeper into the dark world of vice.
He was taking prostitutes to the Caribbean. He was injecting vast amounts of cocaine, large amounts of cocaine. He was supporting almost a part of the underground in terms of the sex trade and the drug trade in London, Ontario. He was out of control.
And the repercussions of Helmut's wild life are being felt at home by his long-suffering wife, Hannah.
It's just a big portion.
No, Helmut, not again, no.
He was picking up venereal diseases and passing them on to his wife. And he would tell her, well, the doctor says you should take these pills too.
Good people don't get it.
In the course of a year, $1 million had been taken out of the companies and had disappeared.
It's not just your life. It's my life and the children.
Hannah discovered this and was fearful. She said, Helmut, the future of our children, of our family, is at stake here. You can't fritter that away. We have to do something about this.
Hannah may be God-fearing, but she's not afraid of lowlifes. She confronts Helmut's suppliers.
My mother went to these drug dealers and told them if they didn't leave her husband alone, she was going to turn them all in.
The pushers do not want to lose their prized millionaire client.
They didn't want to lose their meal ticket. They had them right where they wanted them, except she was interfering.
Helmut also resents Hannah for trying to stop the good times. He's tired of his nagging wife. But divorce is not an option.
He'd made himself a self-made man, and to give up half of what he had made and to lose his wife and possibly the affections of his children, that wasn't in the cards. He wouldn't do it.
All is not well in the Buxbaum household. But in July 1984, Helmut's nephew Roy visits from British Columbia. The troubled couple put on a cheerful face and drive to Toronto Airport to collect him. Young Roy is going to wish he'd stayed home.
On the return from the airport, Hannah Buxbaum, Helmut Buxbaum, are in the station wagon. The nephew, Roy Buxbaum's in the back seat. They've picked him up from the airport, and they're heading home to Kamoka. They've been on the road. They're tired. It's been a hot day. Buxbaum sees a vehicle ahead.
The car appears to have broken down, and Helmut insists on pulling over to help. But it's a fatal mistake. A seemingly drug-crazed attacker demands cash and valuables, but appears suddenly to lose patience and drags Hannah from the car.
On your knees.
Then, within seconds, he ends her life.
Don't do this to me.
pulled the trigger 3 times. One bullet into her temple, crashed around in her brain. Another bullet struck her in the arm. A third bullet went astray.
The gunman races off before Helmut waves down an approaching vehicle. But it's too late for Hannah Buxbaum.
She crumpled in the ditch and within moments was breathing her last. She died there at the side of the road.
Police are called to the scene.
It's hard to ask.
Helmut tells the officers it was a robbery gone wrong, but investigators are puzzled. How does petty theft lead to a murder execution? And why Hannah?
What was the purpose of shooting Hannah? There wasn't a resistance. There wasn't a struggle to not let him rob. And why would they shoot the wife, who normally wouldn't be deemed a threat?
He's the millionaire nursing home operator. She's just a passenger along for the ride.
On your knees! On your knees!
Something isn't adding up. And there's one question on everyone's mind.
What really happened here?
Before sunset the following day, a break in the case will lead detectives to the shocking answer. Religious man and millionaire nursing home tycoon Helmut Buxbaum is living a double life.
6 days of the week, he's pursuing cocaine, prostitutes. The seventh day was church, family.
When his lovely wife Hannah is shot dead by the side of the road, Helmut tells police it's a robbery gone wrong. But a lot of questions need answering.
How does a robbery go bad when someone gets shot in the head?
Detectives are suspicious of Helmut's apparent lack of grief.
His behavior didn't seem to be that of a grieving husband.
Helmut admits he did nothing to protect his wife from the attacker.
She was a saint, and he stood by while a saint was slain.
Then, the evening after the murder, there's a break in the case.
We had information come to us that a gentleman had met Helmut Buxbaum at the London airport.
They arrest the unidentified man back in Toronto with cocaine in his possession. The man is Robert Squirrel Barrett, Helmut's dealer.
Peace.
Police learn of Helmut's seedy lifestyle of drugs and hookers. Could Hannah have been the victim of an underworld dispute? Then, another turn in the investigation. A highway patrol officer saw Helmut and Hannah stop for the same blue vehicle on the opposite side of the same road on the same day, a few hours before the murder. Why would Helmut stop twice in one day for the same car, unless he knew who he was stopping for?
I'm a good Samaritan. I always stop with...
Detectives haul Buxbaum in for questioning.
Partway through the interview, a determination was made that this man is lying to us. And with the evidence that we had collected up to that point, there was more than sufficient grounds to believe that he, in fact, did have a hand in killing his wife. And he was arrested, charged with first-degree murder, and lodged in a cell that day.
That same day, Helmut's dealer, Squirrel Barrett, is also questioned. And this time, he sings like a chipmunk. He admits Helmut had been pestering him for months to do something about his interfering wife.
As the pressure mounts, and as Hannah is trying to interfere with his lifestyle more and more, he's realizing, hey, the good times are at risk here, folks, and my wife is causing problems, and the gravy train is going to end unless you can help me get rid of my wife.
About 2 weeks later, police pick up the gunman Squirrel hired for the job and begin to piece together the answer they've been searching for. What really happened that day?
The gunmen were to wait along the side of the major highway on the way to Toronto, and Helmut Buxbaum would pull up behind the car, and they'd make like there was some sort of car trouble.
This, explains the gunman, is the morning attempt that was foiled by the arrival of a provincial trooper. Then, Buxbaum called Squirrel from Toronto Airport to arrange a second attempt.
He has ice water in his veins. Not once, but twice in One day, he's delivered his wife into the hands of her killer.
This time, no one comes to Hannah's rescue. Not even her own husband.
She looks over to her husband for help, and he's just standing there passively, not doing anything. She realizes, uh-oh, honey, no, please, not this way, she begs her husband.
Hannah Buxbaum has the terrible realization that her own husband has planned her execution.
She knew that she was going to die, and she knew that her husband had orchestrated it. That would be a terrible thought to take to the grave.
She turns to the gunman. She says, no, please, I have 6 children at home. Please don't do this. The gunman, seeing the wife getting no response from her husband, pleading with him for her life, turns to the husband and says,
it should be you, you son of a bitch.
When a low-life hitman looks down on you with disgust, you know you've hit rock bottom. But investigators soon discover Helmut Buxbaum has even further to sink. Turns out he had arranged to profit from Hannah's death.
A number of months before the killing, he took out a life insurance policy on Hannah's life for $1 million.
After paying the agreed fee of $25,000 for his wife's murder, the insurance payout would leave Helmut with a handsome $975,000 profit.
I just can't imagine that, the cold-bloodedness of that.
In October 1985, Helmut Buxbaum goes on trial for first-degree murder, and a rogues gallery of witnesses dishes the dirt on their infamous millionaire client. Helmut Buxbaum gets life in prison with the possibility of parole after 25 years.
Ultimately, 2 years shy of his first opportunity for parole, Helmut dies in prison of a heart attack. One imagines as he breathed his last, the question must have crossed his mind. Is it heaven or hell for Helmut Buxbaum?
In November 2007, Helmut is buried alongside his wife Hannah in Kamoka Cemetery, Ontario. On their headstone is engraved a passage from Revelations. Their works do follow them. For some, the deadly sins of lust and murder lead only to damnation. But Helmut's son, Philip Buxbaum, believes his saintly mother, Hannah, still has forgiveness in her heart.
She's with my mother now. That's something she would want. She would want her Helmut back. She really would.
Helmut Buxbaum and Robert Durst, two multimillionaires with the sky their only limit to success, driven underground by dark deeds and unspeakable desires. They shunned the spotlight and tried to conceal their deadly sins, but their dalliances with murder exposed the sordid details of their secret lives. Till next we meet, behind mansion walls, I'm Christopher Mason.